Morning is number 1250394, Crescent Resources Litigation Trust versus Fields. Mr. McCarthy?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
May it please the Court. My name is Jim McCarthy, and I represent the Crescent Resources Litigation Trust, the appellate in the proceedings. The trust was created by the plan of reorganization in the Crescent bankruptcy, which is a very large, very extensive bankruptcy covering a large part of the country and over 120 companies.
What assets did Crescent have?
Crescent was a diversified real estate company, and it had real estate assets of all different types and sizes throughout the country, commercial.
Is that like the hotel in Dallas?
No, that's another Crescent company.
Oh, okay.
you're thinking of. But a lot of assets, but the problem is, and it's not necessarily directly relevant to what we're talking about today, is that as its parent Duke cashed out, it loaded $1.2 billion in debt on the company, and that sank the company. And as a result, it was a company that was suitable for reorganization, but it was also one that left its creditors holding a $1.6 billion bag. Pretty serious stuff. We're the trust. Our job is to try and recover for those people as much as we can. These proceedings that are before the court are part of the effort to recover money, and they all concern the effort to recover bonuses from executives of the company. There are, in fact, 30 cases wrapped up in this appeal. It's a direct appeal from bankruptcy court orders, and the parties have agreed to certify two questions to this court. But both of them boil down to the simple question of whether this trustee is empowered to bring avoidance actions against these defendants under 11 U.S.C. Section 544, which is, as the court knows, is one of the major, major tools that is available to a bankruptcy trustee. According to the defendants, the trustee lacks standing to assert the Section 544 action under the United Operating Case Law. And they say so it's because it's inadequately reserved under 1123B3B of the code. Defendants took that position, though the code and the disclosure statement repeatedly state that Section 544 avoidance actions are going to be asserted by the trustee, and they say it straightforwardly, indirectly, by category, and by name, over and over and over again. And they also take that position despite the fact that the bankruptcy court found expressly that the trustee's Section 544 claim had been reserved in specific and unequivocal language.
So where did the bankruptcy court, how'd they miss this?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
How did the bankruptcy court miss that clear language?
It put it in each of the orders, in all 30 of the orders, and then having done that, which we would argue that concludes the question.
Right.
That's all that needs to be done. The court then turned around and said, because you didn't reserve a state law fraudulent transfer action, which we weren't asserting, you can't assert the one I said you could assert.
Just one follow-up question of mine. Was that a sua sponte bankruptcy court observation, or was that a briefed?
It was a mix. It's very hard to articulate the rationale behind this. It took place over a number of hearings and a number of cases. And eventually, because a ruling was made in one case, it was then imported into the others. And the parties responsibly said, well, we should really figure this one out before we go on with 30 cases. And that's why we agreed to a direct appeal to this court.
Okay.
But there's no opinion for you to look at, Your Honor. There's nothing that clearly would state how this came about. There is no law in support
of it. Is it your belief that the district court just misunderstood the conduit through 540? Is it not that simple?
No, I think I would object to the conduit idea, and will shortly. But there seems to have been a fundamental misunderstanding. And I think to be charitable about it, you have to remember that this is pre-MPF Holdings, the recent case. It's pre the period in which the Illinois case in which the defendants based their case, before that was totally reversed by the Northern District of Illinois. And so there's some pretty significant pieces of information that the bankruptcy court didn't have that it now has. And this court now has. With the court's permission, I'd like to talk a little bit about 1123B because I think it gets lost in the talk about the case law. And 1123B3B is a very simple statute. It's in two parts, basically. It says in the first half, these are the things that shall be in a plan of reorganization. The second half, B, says these are the things that may be in a plan of reorganization. The one we're talking about is that the plan may provide for the retention and enforcement by the debtor, by the trustee, or a representative of the estate appointed for such purpose of any claims or interests belonging to the debtor or to the estate. And it simply tells you what can be in a plan. It doesn't tell you exactly how you should reserve it. It just tells you that it can be in a plan. Now, I want to, before I go on and talk about how simply this all works out, if it's viewed properly, I want to point to a couple of words in there. One is it's about claims. It's not about pieces of claims. It's not about elements of claims. It's about claims.
However, we do know that if you have plan language that reserves any and all claims, it reserves none. Right?
Yes, I think, Your Honor, that you can do that.
But the question is the level of specificity when you specifically referred to Section 544.
Yes, and we do repeatedly refer to Section 544 as a claim. As many other cases have that have been endorsed in the circuit, in the district courts,
What's the principal difference here? Is it the statute of limitations?
That's one of them. It tends to give you more flexibility, and in a large case like this one, you come in, of course, as Your Honor knows, with a 108 period, which allows you 2 years to sort things out. But the first year or more is going to be, absorbed in trying to put this company back together and get it on its feet again, which is what happened. And then thereafter, it's scrambling to try and get in under and figure out what exactly happened that led to the downfall of the company. All that is pretty significant stuff. But 1123B, the one thing everybody agrees about in every court in the land is that it's a notice provision. And its entire purpose, to quote the Texas-Wyoming court, is to place creditors on notice of the claims the post-confirmation debtor, or in this case, the litigation trust, intends to pursue. And so the real question before this court is actually a pretty simple one. It is whether the Crescent plan and disclosure statement place creditors on notice of the Section 544 claims that the litigation trustee intended to pursue. And it did, over and over and over. And not only that, the judge ruled that it did, over and over and over. The wild card here is the introduction into the equation of this theory, and that's all it is, a theory, because there's no case law that supports it, that you also must reserve a state law fraudulent transfer action in order to assert a 544 action that you actually have reserved. There's nothing to support that notion anywhere, in any law, anywhere. And the original analysis that went into it was focused on a Northern District of Illinois case that has subsequently been tossed out by the Northern District of Illinois, and it confused the fact that in that case there was a chance to reserve 544, there was a chance to reserve the state law fraudulent transfer cause of action, and in that case they failed to reserve the 544. It was that simple. The one didn't have anything to do with the other. This case is the only one that says you've got to take those two separate things and make them mutually interdependent. There's no case law that supports that in this circuit or anywhere else. So we have a very strange situation that occurred, and it occurred in the context with a lot of back and forth until the court's recent decisions have started to elaborate on what United Operating meant and provided a lot more guidance in addition to what United Operating. And now we're seeing, a body of law that's helping people sort out what should be in plans. And I think all that's very, very helpful. I do want to reserve some time for rebuttal, so let me just simply say that there are a number of important aspects that are practical considerations here. And let me give you the first two, and maybe I'll address the others later.
Well, I do want to hear about your fields issue.
Okay, the fields issue is
completely,
Your Honor,
different.
I'll save the other issues for rebuttal. Mr. Fields has a very large claim. I represent Mr. Fields, represent the trust in the Fields case. And it's brought against him. What's different about him is that he is prominently featured in the plan schedule 1.2.
Well, I read that, of course, although it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, and as I understood it, he was only mentioned in connection with his employment agreement, but not for the bonus payment.
The bonus payments are part of his employment agreement, Your Honor.
Oh, well, I thought they were special and separate and it made to induce him to go along with this sucking out of the capital.
He has two bonus plans. One is a $38 million payment he receives as part of the transaction. It's part of the formation and sale agreement. It's part of the deal, and it relates to him switching employers from formerly Duke to now Crescent. It's a huge payment to him, and that bonus is expressly totally tied as part of the employment arrangements that are mentioned in Schedule 1.2 itself. He has another bonus a year later, which, you know, you can make an argument that it's not related to the transaction. We think it is, but that'll be decided in the courts below when we actually litigate the matter.
Well, but the previous, the big money is the $38 million one, and you mainly have a circumstantial case that it's part of the overall transaction, right?
No, it's not circumstantial at all, Your Honor. It's just simply, it's not in the record. In fact, Mr. Fields, when he signed the agreements that made the deal occur, there is a disclaimer in there that says, and this is not part of the record, but you asked the question, there's a disclaimer that says, I have a conflict of interest because this deal is going to give me entirely new arrangements. So he votes on the deal anyway, but at least he announces his conflict. The two are tied totally together. And that'll be developed, of course, for the trial. I'd like to reserve a few minutes.
Yes, but again, I mean, you went to great lengths Section 1.2 to describe what had gone on in the Duke transaction and that there were causes of action against everybody and so on. And it seems to me that I just have an intuition that $38 million is probably one of the larger elements of that.
The suit against the Duke, et cetera, is in the.
I mean, surely you knew about that at the time.
No, it's not clear that we knew all of what was going on in the transaction. Buried in a $1.2 billion transaction, where money flowed in a lot of different directions, but mostly to Duke. You know, this was a lower priority to look into compared to the Duke transaction.
Just one question back on 1123. Did we leave open but imply that there would be any reason to interpret 1123 in Texas, Wyoming to require at least mentioning the prospective defendant?
To mention the what?
The prospective defendant by name in terms of specificity. Or is that not, it, did I not?
No, I think that's been foreclosed by the Texas, Wyoming and the
foreclosed by Texas, Wyoming? Okay.
In any case, the plan talks about the prospective use. I'd like to keep my last 2 minutes, if I might, Your Honor.
It's fine.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Buckman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jody Buckman, and I represent the appellees. I think it's important to understand who these appellees are. As Mr. McCarthy stated, Crescent was a very large multi-state real estate development company that developed master plan communities, residential, commercial, multifamily, and land development. So who are these appellees who I will also call the bonus defendants? Well, they're 30 former and current employees of Crescent, and they're located across the United States. They were, for the most part, middle management. They had positions ranging from hands-on work at the various real estate development projects, such as construction manager, sales manager, retail development and marketing. Some were in charge of various real estate projects located across the country. and some ran one of the four divisions at Crescent, and their positions are listed on Addendum 1. A fair amount of the bonus defendants are also creditors. They're owed further compensation from Crescent, and they are, ironically, members of the trust that are suing them. These are former and current employees who were blindsided when, in 2011, up to 4 years after many had left the company, they were sued by the trust to recover bonuses paid to them in early 2007 for work they had performed for the company in 2006. The claims that are asserted are constructive fraudulent transfer and preference claims. For purpose of today, it's the state law constructive fraudulent conveyance claims used through Section 544. Using the specific and unequivocal standard which has been developed in the Fifth Circuit, in reviewing the plan and disclosure statement, there's at least five reasons why the plan does not specifically and unequivocally retain state law fraudulent transfer claims. And I'll start this by saying that merely mentioning Section 544 and the term avoidance action standing alone is not enough. One, there is no mention of asserting state law fraudulent transfer claims, except in Schedule 1.2, which I'll get to later, which only applies according to the trustee to Mr. Fields. Two, there's no mention of any claims to possibly be asserted against former and current employees other than in connection with the Duke lawsuit. Three, there's no mention of any possible claims to avoid and recover bonuses paid to former and current employees. The word bonus appears absolutely nowhere in the plan, the disclosure statement, or the litigation trust agreement. Four, there's nothing in the disclosure statement or the liquidating trust agreement that adds anything more specific and unequivocal than does the plan. And number five, nothing in Schedule 1.2 of the plan adds anything more specific and unequivocal. In fact, when boiled down, the only language in the plan of related documents references just two things.
Well, let me just go ahead, and then I'll ask you.
Sure. Section 544 and avoidance actions.
Yes. Well, speaking of that, I mean, there are a lot of big, big bankruptcy cases where, at the end of the day, a litigation trust or unsecured creditors committee or the reorganized debtor is going to enhance the assets available to creditors by chasing down preference claims. And there may be thousands and thousands of preference claims. And what I perceive as I perceive two big difficulties with your argument here. One is, if you are saying that specific and unequivocal means you have to identify all the, all the potential defendants, the nature of the claim, when you're going after a bonus, if it's a preference, it's a preference. It doesn't matter whether it's a bonus or a subsidy for the rent cars. It's still a preference. That's my first claim. I think you're going way beyond what any reasonable bankruptcy lawyer would consider the requirement of specificity of the nature, the factual underpinning of the claim. Number two, on the legal basis, 544, I haven't done bankruptcy as a practitioner for a long time, but 544 to me meant fraudulent conveyance, and 544 also refers to or embodies state law Tufta claims, period. So what's your best argument for divorcing, for your position then?
Well, Your Honor, first I would agree with you that with respect to preferences, mentioning Section 547 and preference claims is sufficient. You clearly don't have to list all of the potential defendants down the road or even specificity with respect to what you're going to be seeking to recover. However, I would say with respect to the state law fraudulent transfer claims, there are seven cases in the Fifth Circuit which we believe show that in order to specifically and unequivocally retain state law fraudulent transfer claims using 544, you would have to say in the plan or disclosure statement that you need to say both Section 544 and state
Not
law.
Not one of them says that in those terms. You're inferring, and I read several of those cases, and I'm sorry I don't have them with me here because but not one of them went that far.
If I could refer to at least the cases, Your Honor, say that claims were specifically and unequivocally retained where the terms 544 and the term state law fraudulent transfer were mentioned in the plan or the disclosure statement.
Well, that doesn't prove the contrary, however.
I believe it lends credence to the fact that in order to be specific and unequivocal, you would have to say both. Because 544, and you know, granted, the trust says 544, not 544B. 544 can be used for a myriad of causes of action, breach of fiduciary duty, constructive trust, and others.
Yes, that's precise, and I think that ought to be sufficient. I am not at all sure why the plan need be any more specific than, say, avoidance actions and 544. What's your best authority that it has to be more specific than that?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the Texas, Wyoming, and the Tepper case and Judge Gargatta's decision in the Crescent versus Burr case show that creditors would not be on notice simply by reading a plan and disclosure statement that say 544 and avoidance actions of all of the claims that could arise using 544 as a vehicle or a conduit or a mechanism. They're not 544 causes of action, we contend. They're more using 544 to assert state law claims. These creditors would not be on notice of what state law claims would possibly be asserted.
Well, if you say avoidance actions and you're an unsecured, if the plan says avoidance actions and you're an unsecured creditor who's gotten paid $10,000 within a year, within 90 days of bankruptcy, or even within a year of bankruptcy, you know, if you're well represented, you know there's going to be some risk.
I would agree with you in that situation, Your Honor, because there you're talking about a preference under 547.
But I also said within a couple of years.
Within 2 years, you would be talking about a federal fraudulent conveyance under 548. But the appellee's contention is that with respect to going further back, we're talking about folks that were paid in early 2007 for work performed in 2006, that when they received a plan and disclosure statement some 5 years later, would not be on notice that they could potentially be at risk under a state law fraudulent transfer.
But the bankruptcy was filed in 08, wasn't it?
The bankruptcy was filed in 09.
09. So that was only 2 years after some of the bonuses accrued, number one. And number two, the debtor could have sued them immediately. The fact that it happened 5 years later instead of 2 or 3 years later has to do with the priority. So I'm not sure that that changes the notice.
I think it
situation.
Does change it to a certain degree, respectfully, since the bankruptcy was filed in June of 2009 and the payments were in January of 2007, okay. So it would have been more than 2 years. Plus, Your Honor, these folks, a lot of them still worked for Crescent.
Well, I mean, that's life. If you represent a creditor, it's very unfortunate. But it may be grasping on their part, but it's still the letter of the law, perhaps. Now, I respect Judge Gargatta a great deal, but I do not see that he had any reasoning in this connection. I mean, that his opinion was quite conclusory.
Well, I think he does provide more insight in the Crescent versus Burr case, which is at 463 BR 423, which was Ed Burr is a defendant in the bonus cases, but he was also sued separately by the trust. In another case.
Yeah, but again, I think I read that was in the record excerpts, wasn't it?
Correct, it was in the addendum.
Right, and I read that, and again, I'm sorry that was several weeks ago, but all he did was cite various of the cases around the country, none of which is really on point, and then he says this wasn't specific enough.
Well, I believe that his decision was based more on the fact that it wasn't specific and unequivocal enough because it just mentioned 544, not 544B, and it didn't mention anything about state law claims
or
state law fraud.
Well, 544 is Part A and Part B, right? So if you refer to 544, it includes 544A and B. I don't see that that's a particularly difficult concept.
I understand. I would just submit that I think the term specific and unequivocal should encompass more than just listing a code section and should include the state law claims that are potentially to be asserted. I don't think it imposes much of a burden on someone drafting a plan to throw additional language in where we know in the cases within the Fifth Circuit that mentioning the term state law fraudulent transfer along with 544 would be enough to be specific and unequivocal. We didn't see a case where just listing 544 and the term avoidance actions alone was enough to be specific and unequivocal. In all of the cases, it did say it was specific and unequivocal, only when it referenced the state law fraudulent transfer claim. And that's the basis for our position. And the Tepper case, which was in our letter that we submitted, was a similar case in that the trust there didn't have standing to pursue a fraudulent transfer claim under state law because the plan only provided for avoidance claims under the bankruptcy code sections. And it listed 544 there as well. And so while that's a case in the bankruptcy court and it's not within the Fifth Circuit, we believe that when you put all these cases together, it's not enough to just say 544 and avoidance actions. To put these creditors on notice, many who ended up being the defendants certainly wouldn't have been on notice and weren't on notice that they were going to get sued in 2011. If I could address just for a moment the Schedule 1.2 and the Mr. Fields claim, our contention is that the Schedule 1.2 did not include the Fields bonus. As Your Honor mentioned during Mr. McCarthy's argument, Schedule 1.2 is pretty specific when it comes to what was part of the Duke transaction. It specifically describes that transaction in detail. It provides the specific agreements, the specific amounts that were paid.
The breaches of fiduciary duties, right?
Yes, Your Honor. In that instance, you have a situation where clearly the trust was, whoever drafted the plan, was ensuring that they'd be able to bring state law claims. And there they specifically made a list of the potential claims. And indeed, they brought them. Schedule 1.2, Your Honors, refers to the Duke lawsuit. And Mr. Fields is a party to the Duke lawsuit. He was sued in the Duke lawsuit for claims such as wrongful distributions, breach of fiduciary duty, civil conspiracy, claim objections. There's nothing in this lawsuit about bonuses. And I just question that if this was really so integral of a part of the 2006 transaction, why was it filed as a separate lawsuit to, quote, avoid and recover bonus payments, unquote? I find that really curious. And you're talking about a $1 billion lawsuit. You're talking about a $37 million payment. I would say that's pretty specific to be mentioned. The employment agreement that's mentioned for Mr. Fields in Schedule 1.2 does reference a 2% interest that Mr. Fields was going to be receiving in Crescent. Doesn't mention anything about a bonus. And the trust didn't file anything with respect to that 2% interest.
Was this an extraordinary bonus?
Well, Your Honor, you're talking about a company that qualified for a loan of over $1 billion. Was it an extraordinary? If the allegations of the complaint are believed to be true, I don't believe that it was an extraordinary bonus. Now, when the facts come to light, obviously there will be a lot of that's
but
not
I
part
mean,
of the record.
My phraseology wasn't clear. I mean, it's not within the terms of the employment agreement, or it is within the term. In other words, sometimes executive employment agreement, I think, will say that every year you may qualify for, you know, stock options or a bonus. And sometimes it gives formulas. So.
It did. The employment agreement that Mr. Fields entered into with Crescent as part of the Duke transaction did provide for bonuses going forward. However, it did not address the $37 million payment.
And why was that?
Well, Your Honor, this isn't in the record, so to speak, but the $37 million payment was a payment made by Duke, not by Crescent, to buy out Mr. Fields' employment agreement with Duke. But for purposes of being specific and unequivocal, I think Schedule 1.2 provides the court with guidance on the fact that the trust did make a concerted effort to specifically and unequivocally reserve the state law claims when it came to the Duke causes of action, but didn't when it came to any other causes of action. And we submit that Under the case law as it currently exists, especially within the Fifth Circuit and the cases that we cited in our briefs and in the subsequent letter to the court, that all of the cases that held that state law fraudulent transfer claims were specifically and unequivocally retained had language either in the plan or in the disclosure statement that state law claims, including state law fraudulent transfer claims, would be asserted. Unless the court has further questions.
No.
Thank you.
We have your argument. Thank you very much. Mr. McCarthy.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have just a few points. I want to go back to Judge Higgins' comment on the conduit theory, because I do think there's a misunderstanding there that's maybe reflected in some of the documents you've seen in the briefing. The real trick here is to look at 544 itself. There's no conduit notion there. If you look at 544 itself, it establishes a federal claim. It defines the scope of it as a federal claim. It is regulated by 546, 502, 548, and is enforceable through 550. It's a bankruptcy claim. What is unique about subsection B is that it says you can look to applicable law. Now, applicable law doesn't even have to be state law. In some cases, it's federal, and that was a big issue in the torch liquidation case before this court, where the court ultimately decided it wasn't federal, it was going to be one of two states. So it's not a conduit, it's a standalone, and like a lot of other kinds of federal law, it chooses to incorporate an appropriate state law if that's what's required. And so when these cases that Mr. Buckman shows you say talk about a state law cause of action and then also talk about a federal law cause of action, it's simply the court making a judgment as to the retention of each of those and whether it was satisfactory. The Tepper case, to which you just referred, for instance, is a simple enough case where the trustee tried to assert both, and the court held you succeeded as to 544, but you did not succeed as to the state law claims. Pretty straightforward stuff. But it doesn't do what the defendants here are asking you to do, which is to say, aha, because we got a gotcha on the state law claims, you therefore lose the 544 claims that I've already said are good.
Well, you would agree that this plan was about as bare bones in the description of the avoidance actions as you could get away with.
I think one is, it's a wild gotcha product that wasn't there, Your Honor.
No,
but,
I know.
But we see a lot of the same language, and in fact, if you look at the Tepper opinion, you see sort of the same language there regarding avoidance actions. If you look at some of the other recent cases, you'll see the same language. It does say, you know, it reserves them quite clearly and I think adequately on all the laws, all the precedents in this court and in the other courts of the land. Because it's such a basic tool in the toolbox of a trustee. And the range of things that can be brought into it is it's not an argument for adopting the proposal of the defendants. What that would require then is now we have a wide array of United operating problems where whatever is included or might be included would have to be disclosed, and you would have a docket full of these things. The last point I want to make is concerns of practical effects, because these are troubling. If the court voted for the defendants, one problem we would have, of course, is that if you think of the plan as a contract, as the Fifth Circuit law does, what you have to do to enforce them is to literally write out every reference to Section 544 and every reference to avoidance actions as if they're not there. And then there's the other side of that. If this court would now say, in following the defendants, that, oh, by the way, all those statements you made to the creditors about 544 and you're bringing actions that aren't true, what's the consequence of that? I can tell you there'd be some very disappointed creditors who thought they had formed and funded a litigation trust to actually litigate. And they find out that, you know, in fact, the plan doesn't say what it is. I say, you know, and on behalf of my client.
I mean, her argument is, suppose you funded the litigation trust only to find out that you're one of the targets.
And everyone who relied on the fact, and remember, We represent $1.6 billion in losses. They are not going to be paid any way but by the activities of the litigation trust. And so the idea that they would be thinking they were looking at a plan that gave 544 powers to the trust in many different ways and saying that means he doesn't have 544 powers is not something you would like to see happen. Third problem is the obvious one. This would affect 30 cases. And there are 30 cases which will never get to the merits on these issues if they're lost. Nine of them are non-interlocutory, and they would go away right away. The rest would be tried on additional counts or amended 544 counts. And the last thing that's, you know, goes to the sort of the jurisprudential issue is the court's building a lot of precedent now based on Your Honor's United Operating opinion. And what they're asking for is counterintuitive. We don't need counterintuitive guidance to plan drafters. Time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll be in recess until 9:00.